This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's summertime and it's pretty hot, so why not take a trip to the beach? Connecticut's coastal beaches are unfairly maligned, I feel, by some who prefer the bigger ocean waves of Rhode Island. I say they're wrong. Hammonasset Beach in Madison is one of my favorite places. Calm waters lapping against a pristine strip of sand. But in Connecticut, those sandy strips are few and far between. A lot of our coastline is rocky. It's also very, very private. We don't have the kinds of beach access that Californians or Cape Codders enjoy. For the public beaches we do have, there is some news this year. Some higher fees to park your car, ongoing restoration efforts after a few big storms the last few years, and high bacteria levels that periodically shut beaches down. Today, where we live, we're going to take a look at the state of Connecticut's beaches. Throw on your flip-flops and join us. You can call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're joined in studio by Robert Klee. He is the Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Good to see you once again, Commissioner. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also, James Tate is here. He's a professor of science education and environmental studies at Southern Connecticut State University, co-coordinator at the Wirth Center for Coastal and Marine Studies. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Jennifer O'Donnell is here, CEO of Coastal Ocean Analytics, a professor at UConn's Department of Marine Sciences. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us today is our science reporter, Patrick Scahill, who covers the environment for us. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, John.
Hey, I'll actually start with you, Patrick, because you've been covering a lot of things having to do with the beach. And I just want to maybe give our listeners a rundown of some of the things that we're going to be talking about. I mentioned bacteria levels at beaches, but we're going to be talking about something called Beach nourishment.
It's a very interesting engineering slash science slash ecology field where basically you're trying to match sand that comes from another place and bring it into a beach to make the coast a little bit more resilient.
Interesting.
Our guests will explain a lot better.
Oh, interesting. We'll be talking about that. Patrick, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite beach in Connecticut? Is there a beach that you go to?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's ironic because I was telling my girlfriend this morning that I was going on the beach show and she's like, you hate beaches. I'm not an ocean person.
Patrick, for those who don't know him, he's the world's most Irish guy. This is not a man who tans well. Well, we're going to learn a lot about beaches where you can go sunbathing or swimming or just look from afar. First of all, Commissioner Klee, let's start with you and let's talk about just a few things that are new this year. I mean, if people haven't yet been to Connecticut beaches, especially those run by the DEP yet this year, what's something that they would see that's maybe new in 2015 that they didn't know in 2014?
Oh, something new in 2015. Well, at Sherwood Island, our beach down in Westport, we have a brand new pavilion. Well, we've actually renovated the historic pavilion there, actually done some creative new sort of energy upgrades, new lighting, better bathrooms, a new snack bar there, solar on the roof. It's really a great example of how we're trying to lead by example in our state park properties to showcase both the fun things you can do at the beach, plus learn a little about energy and alternative energy and those sorts of things.
I know that some of the building that you've been doing at the state parks and coastal areas over the last few years has been built a bit back off the shore from where it was. I mean, I talked about Hammonasset. This is a place I spend a lot of time in the summertime. The older fashioned beach pavilions are built right up there on the water, and those have sustained some damage from storm surges over the years. The new pavilion you built was quite a little bit of a ways back behind the dunes. I'm sure there's a reason for that.
No, and that's on purpose, and that's to make a more resilient structure there on our west beach. And so folks will see that we're building back behind the dunes. We're also moving up. So when the new pavilion is in place, hopefully for the beach season next year, it's going to have a great deck, actually, quite up high, great views of Long Island Sound. The other really cool thing, and for those who don't want to be on the sand, Patrick, you can come down to Hammonasset. There's a great birding opportunities there in the marshes and in the back areas. And we have a new nature center that's being built in partnership with the Friends of Hammonasset. There's going to be a state-of-the-art facility with real great interpretive items. So you don't have to go.
I feel better.
Great. And you can learn a lot about science, actually, down there. It's really one of our joint missions is to get people excited about the outdoors, thinking about the environment, and getting kids and families really out there enjoying interacting with nature instead of the little screens or the big screens that folks spend too much time on, I think.
And it's amazing. People still bring the little screens to the beach. You notice this all the time. I do have to ask you, though, about the slightly higher fees at some of these beaches. This isn't a rise in the actual cost of the pass to get on the beach, but it's actually a tax on the pass to the beach. Can you explain that and explain how the costs went up?
Sure, happy to. And we charge parking fees at only 25 of our 109 park locations, and for 15 of those, it's just on the weekends, for daily at the other 10. It's basically a tax on the existing fee structure. So what used to be a $9 weekday resident fee is now $9.57. It's our Connecticut state sales tax. And we're rolling it out as fast as we can. We're complying with the law as quickly as we can. So you'll see it at the major shoreline parks, the Hammonasset, Rocky Neck, Sherwood Island. They're already charging that fee. We're rolling it out as quickly as we can in the other parks. And it's was something that passed this law, a new sort of change passed during the implementer session. It's estimated to, I think, bring in around $250,000 in tax revenue.
Something that was asked around the legislative session whenever this was passed is, why not just pass a flat fee so that you're not making all this crazy change? I think the cost per car at Hammonasset is, you would know better than me, is like $16.85 or something, which makes for interesting change, and it makes the lines longer, and it probably aggravates everyone along the way. Is that the best way to do this?
No. Short answer. Unfortunately, I can't actually just change it to a round number. We actually have to go for a regulation change in order to do that, and we're in the process of filing that. Unfortunately, reg changes can take upwards of 9 months to implement. So rounding up would make things – but our goal in all of this is to try to do it as smoothly and quickly and work as we can to reduce the burden on the folks who are just trying to come to the
meeting. And I just have to ask one more thing quickly on this. When people go to a state park like a Rocky Neck or a Hammonasset, does that fee go into maintaining the beach itself? Because I think a question always is with any fee that's paid to the state, look, I don't mind paying a little bit more for the beach this year if I know it's going to be to keep the beach clean, to build those brand new buildings, to make sure that the ecosystem is what it should be, or is that money going to the general fund?
The money does go to the general fund, though our overall state parks budget is supported by the fees and other things. We only actually bring in about $6 million roughly from parking, camping, admissions fees at like Gillette Castle and the other places where you charge for the museums. Our budget is about $18 million all in. So that's operating expenses of about $3 million. $3.4 million for our seasonal workers, which when you're in a park in the summer, 90% of the folks there are seasonal workers who do this great job. They're sort of either young sort of folks from college. We have folks who are retirees. But the other sort of $11 million or so is salary and benefits for our 91 staff, full-time staff. So the $6 million in fees doesn't cover the full boat, in essence.
For everything that needs to be done. Yeah.
And Commissioner, you had mentioned that this was passed during the budget implementation process. Can you just talk about a little bit more expansively, like how much – were you guys given any notice about this change, that this was coming?
Not much, no. So we've sort of learned about it after the implementer. I think – this had been in the parking and fees had been in discussions in the sort of the world of the revenue side, which is I have enough committees to sort of look after with energy and environment and planning and development. So we weren't in those discussions or whatnot. And that's where we're now adjusting to it, and we're implementing as fast as we can. And it does take some logistics to make that much change. So that's why we've been going as fast as we can to make that happen.
Reprogram all the cash registers and
exactly. Yeah. No. And actually, most of the change we are mostly sending change out. Most people aren't providing us with the 84 cents in exact change, so we have to make change at most transactions.
We're talking with the Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection today as we consider the state of Connecticut's beaches. And if you have questions or you want to tell us about your favorite beach, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to bring in Jennifer O'Donnell and James Tate to the conversation. So, Jennifer, what makes our beaches unique? I mean, I talked about the fact that I take it personally whenever people say, I'm going to Rhode Island. I can't stand the Connecticut beaches. I think that they're wrong, and I think that they should spend their money here. That's just me. But what makes our coastal environment unique in your mind?
Well, the number one reason is because we're on Long Island Sound. We're not an open ocean beach. And so typically when a coastal engineer thinks of a beach, or most people think of a beach, they think of New Jersey, the long, straight, dune-backed beaches. But Connecticut, because of its geology, has very small pocket beaches, so little crescent-shaped beaches with headlands on each end. We've got rocky bluffs. We've got soft bluffs. And so when we need to make decisions about our beaches, they're going to be made on very short scales compared to a traditional New Jersey, North Carolina, Florida beach.
So how does that change the way you actually have to think about conservation? If you're dealing with these small little beaches with rocky ends on either side as opposed to these big long stretches?
Well, and when you do a coastal engineering project, the larger the project, the more cost effective it is. So in Connecticut, when we want to nourish a beach, it's going to be a very small beach that we're going to nourish. We also want to use different approaches. If we've got a small crescent-shaped beach with headlands, then groins aren't really as important as on a long, straight beach. A groin is a structure perpendicular to the shoreline that stops the sand from moving along the shore. In a pocket beach, your headlands kind of keep that sand in that pocket. In addition, we've got we don't have a lot of marshes behind the beaches. If you think of, once again, New Jersey, they have a lot of bays behind the beaches. Because of the topography, we have uplands. And so this makes a very different situation than a lot of other places that are responding to coastal processes.
James, how about you? I'd like to get your thoughts on what makes Connecticut's beach environment unique, perhaps, in the country.
So I come from California, so I have a very different perspective on beaches, and there are some substantial differences. And to me, the first thing I noticed, you know, being actually an ex-surfer, for example, that the waves in Long Island Sound are rather small, except during storms.
There's not a whole lot of surfing going on the Connecticut shoreline. No.
Me and some of my colleagues actually have started something called the Hammonasset Surf Club. We have a T-shirt already, and maybe that's something you would like to join.
I would join that, actually.
Yeah, Patrick, would you? Yeah, can we sit far offshore drinking beer? If we can do that, I'm in. but so obviously it's not like California. I mean, there's some obvious ways, but describe some ways in which this is a different beach than a California beach.
Okay, so I would say that, you know, related to the waves, we basically are on a very low energy coastline. So that means we have lots of salt marshes, et cetera, environments in which very fine grained sediments can settle out. Also, our more energetic events tend to be storms, which are erosive to the beaches. On a California beach, we have swells coming in from distant storms, i.e., surfable waves, that in the absence of storms, actually push the sand that was eroded back on shore. And what we have in Connecticut is those distant swells, which tend to rebuild the beach after perhaps a stormy winter, are filtered out by the presence of Long Island. So we don't get those kinds of waves. And that makes for, in the long run, a sort of a chronically erosive coastline.
So, okay, chronically erosive coastline. Patrick, maybe this gets us to this point of renourishing the beaches.
Right.
And this is a fascinating thing. I think Jennifer already talked about this. You want to make sure that the sands actually remain in place, and there's lots of different ways to do this. And mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about beach nourishment.
Yeah, and I think another component of this, folks, would be that our coastline is also really, really developed too, right? So when these waves
Absolutely.
Come in, they're small, for one thing, and there's kind of no sand there for them to erode off the rocky bluffs that are on the beach, correct?
Well, yeah. Connecticut is a sediment-starved situation. We don't have the sand available for transport that you have in other locations.
So what do you do to re-nourish a beach? How does that work?
Jennifer, you want to take that? Being the engineer in the group?
To re-nourish a beach, you want to find sediment that's the same grain size, the same composition that's there naturally. If you put too fine a sand on the beach, it's going to erode more quickly. If you put too coarse a sand on the beach, it's not appropriate. So you go for slightly coarser. So you need to find the appropriate sand. And sources include offshore sand and also land-based sand. And it's becoming harder and harder to find sand sources, particularly appropriate sand, as more and more areas are eroding and needing the sand.
Where do we go for our sand if we need to add sand to Connecticut's beaches, Commissioner?
Well, I'll give an example of something we did in partnership with the Army Corps of Engineers. We actually helped dredge, I believe it was Clinton's Harbor, which had sort of gotten choked up with sand, which is right down the, basically right on the border with Hamannassa State Park. And we actually pumped it all out of their harbor, so we were doing a positive there in terms of dredging and moved it over to Hamannassa's beach. So there are occasionally those types of opportunities. We try to take advantage of them whenever we can, though moving large quantities of upland sand or whatnot starts getting expensive.
Well, and I wanted to ask, too, about the question of so who kind of runs point on this and who pays for it ultimately? Because, I mean, on the Connecticut coastline, we have a lot of private beaches that are owned by individual towns. They're not all public beaches. So kind of who runs point on these projects generally?
Well, it depends on whether you can get Army Corps of Engineers support. If the Army Corps of Engineers gets involved, then they have a component that requires a public access. And a lot of private property owners do not want to have their beach become public, in which case you're going to have either the municipality pay it because it's going to provide protection to the rest of the town, or you have private property owners. On big projects, which the Corps finds cost-effective, they pay a large proportion of it.
But as Jennifer said before, we don't have the scale of projects that they would have on Cape Cod or that they would have in New Jersey, right? So can you talk about what happens? I mean, let's go back to the storms of the last few years and some of the damage that has happened to Connecticut's beaches. How much money is being spent? What has to be done still to make sure that the erosion of those storms doesn't then continue year after year?
It's a great question, and this is really an area of sort of active both research at institutions like UConn. I'll actually make a plug. Our agency and UConn and actually with Jennifer's husband, Jim O'Donnell, at the Connecticut Institute for Resilience and Climate Adaptation have been really working on these sorts of issues on how you make communities along our coastline and in our inland floodplains more resilient, because they're asking those same questions. And so we created this partnership with UConn to provide this sort of applied research sort of answers to these tough questions. On the coastline, sort of new innovative techniques in basically creating artificial reefs or sort of living shorelines, things that can dissipate and reduce that incoming wave energy and help protect the beaches behind them are kind of new sort of innovations that we're experimenting with. There's a project in Stratford. We're looking to do others in the New Haven area to find ways to really reduce that energy coming in and protect either the beaches or the coastal marshes or salt marshes behind, which are really critical parts of our natural infrastructure to make communities more resilient.
Yeah, and Jim, maybe you can pick up on that a little bit, because I think that some of these new technologies, these ways in which we can, you know, slow down the waves that are coming in, reduce that energy, but then also make sure that the marshlands behind them are able to do their work as well. I mean, what do you think needs to be done or even studied more on the Connecticut shoreline?
Well, let me just mention that UConn's not the only one that's involved in this. We at Southern have a Wirth Center for Coastal Marine Studies, and we do a lot of applied coastal work. In fact, we're currently working with John Hine at Hamannassa, with the town of East Haven, the town of West Haven, the town of Milford, et cetera. I think one of the issues is if you look at beach, one of the studies we did directly after Sandy, we took beach profiles before and after Sandy, pretty much right before and right after. And we noticed that, and we also looked at the pattern of damages, and we noticed that in the single most important factor in contributing to a reduction of damages by storm waves was where the house or structure is located on the beach profile, i.e. Houses that were built on with a wide beach in front of them suffered zero to very minor damages. Houses that were very close to the high water line, even if they were somewhat elevated, even if they had seawalls, received very severe damages. Mm-hmm. So the beach plays a very important part in protecting structures and infrastructure, because if you think of incoming storm waves as packets of energy, there's a finite number of those packets that are going to be delivered to the shoreline during the storm's life. That energy or those packets can be used to move beach sand or to move structures. So,
but then a flip side of this, though, too, is when you build any sort of structure close to the water, so you're saying obviously the structure is going to have more damage if it's built up to the shoreline during storms as opposed to having a wide sandy beach around it, which, of course, makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that, too, is when you build a structure right up against the water and you protect it with a large seawall, that the presence of that seawall actually aids in further erosion of the beaches around it. And maybe that's something to explain a little bit. That's an important thing, is that the seawall method of protection isn't necessarily the best way to keep beaches or coastal areas from eroding.
That's correct. I mean, in some cases, you need a seawall. In other cases, it could be avoided. It turns out that one of my other areas of expertise, as Jennifer knows, is the impacts of seawalls on beaches. Basically, things that happen is seawalls protect upland properties by focusing wave energy at the base of the wall or on the wall, and that causes erosion in front of the wall. It can also focus wave energy at the ends of the walls. And the kinds of things that happen is you get more sediment suspended because you're focusing wave energy, and you can actually accelerate longshore currents and carry that the sand away. But I think what I was going to say was the presence of a beach. Most of the houses that are too close to the water were not initially built too close to the water.
Sure.
You know, so in East Haven, for example, where I live, looking at old aerial photos, a lot of homes that were originally built with a fairly broad beach in front of them are gone, and the water now exists where those homes used to be. So the de facto plan seems to be whoever's on the beach is there for a while, that house gets turned down, and then the next house becomes the house on the beach, that house gets destroyed, and then the next house becomes...
And then the next one up. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk more about maybe some smarter planning around beach communities, and we're going to be asking some of your questions as well at 860-275-7266. If you have questions about Connecticut's beaches, or maybe you even have some stories to share about your favorite beaches in Connecticut, we'd love to hear from you. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're checking in on the state of Connecticut's beaches with Robert Klee. He's the commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. James Tate, who's a professor of science education and environmental studies at Southern Connecticut State University, also co-coordinator at the Wirth Center for Coastal and Marine Studies. Jennifer O'Donnell, who's CEO of Coastal Ocean Analytics and a professor at UConn's Department of Marine Sciences. And our own Patrick Scahill, he's our science reporter who writes the blog The Beaker, in which you can find all sorts of interesting information about science news both here and around the world. Let's go to the phones here. If you want to join us, by the way, 860-275-7266, as we talk about beaches in our great state. Bernie is in East Hampton. Hi there, Bernie.
Hello, John. Love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on the sales tax, which was maybe not publicized very much before it went into effect. But the state could have just added more tax somewhere else instead of inconveniencing workers and beachgoers. I think that it's akin to the back to toll booths that were eliminated because of the danger. Now, I think they're going to get more money, but they're going to have to build toll booths. They're going to have to pay employees. It just costs more to get more. And if lawmakers would get more input on how things work before they make these rules, it'd be a lot easier on all of us.
Well, Bernie, thank you very much for sharing that. And Commissioner, I'll just say a big concern people always have when fees go up or taxes go up or anything else is that it's a barrier for people to actually go enjoy our parks. And there's this really interesting fine point you got to walk, because it's going to cost money to keep these beaches open, to keep them clean, to keep them beautiful. People are going to have to be out there, lifeguards, toll takers, everything else. at the same point, if people don't go and enjoy the beaches, there's not a clamoring for beaches and for parks. And so talk about walking that line, because as he says, you know, fees go up every year, people might just start staying away, and that's not good.
No, and Bernie has a good sort of frustration. We've heard it about this new tax. But we're in implementation mode. That's kind of the role that we're playing here. The beaches are crowded. People are coming out. We've actually had to close Hammonasset for a couple of weekends ago, and that has 6,000 parking spaces. So people are still coming. Our fees are about on par with where Rhode Island is. Different states have very different ways of collecting fees or not collecting fees at state parks, and there are a bunch of different models out there. We're going to be looking at that in the coming year or so on how one can think about the charging structures. But the good news from my perspective, people are coming out, enjoying the parks. They're bringing their families. We have a great program, actually, the No Child Left Inside program, started by Gina McCarthy, who was a former commissioner of then DEP.
Now heads up the EPA.
Now heads up the EPA. Really geared towards getting kids and families engaged. I have participated with my two boys for the last 4 years. We have a spring sprint, a park pursuit, where you go to a new park each weekend. You get clues to the next one. You do fishing and forestry and swimming and boating and learn about all the great sort of things we do in our natural world, and really geared towards kids and families. They have a great website. So if you're looking for an idea of where to go, what to do, what a good hike is for kids and families, go to our website. The No Child Left Inside sort of corner has great ideas to get people out and enjoying.
We got a question from Christine that gets us to one of the things we wanted to talk about. She wants us to ask, what's the safest beach in Connecticut as far as purity is concerned? Purity is an interesting word that could mean a lot of things, but I think what she means is the safe beach as far as bacteria levels, or in terms of a beach that's going to be safe to take your kids and the water is going to be very, very clean. I know, Patrick, it's something that we've been looking at a lot. I mean, it feels like we're seeing more beach closures, but maybe not. Have you looked into that at all?
Well, I mean, I think that would be a good question for the commissioner. I mean,
thanks, Patrick.
We get these emails. I get these emails daily that say beaches are open, beaches are closed. I know you folks are out testing these beaches, I think, on pretty much a regular basis during the mm-hmm. summer. Just kind of talk about the testing process and how that's all done.
Sure. Happy to do it. We test our shoreline swimming areas on Monday. We get results on Tuesday. We test our inland swimming areas either Monday or Tuesday. We have that one-day turnaround. We have 23 designated state park swim areas. So I'm actually only talking about our state beaches. Mm-hmm. The towns have similar sort of testing protocols. The results are generally pretty good, particularly at our large shoreline parks. I went back, had folks sort of pull some of the data. Hammonasset has only closed once in 12 years, actually, for an exceedance of the bacteria counts. This is really often a question of the location of a particular beach, not just our state beaches, but your local town beach, and the things around it that are happening, whether there's sewage treatment plants or runoff or whatnot. This is where bacterial sort of counts sort of can come into play. CFE, the Connecticut Fund for the Environment and Save the Sound, have actually launched a new, very interesting interactive website that lets you look at historic trends of mm-hmm. of beach closures, I think with 10 years of
10
data.
10 years going back, yeah.
Yeah, on this interactive sort of website. I was at their board meeting a week or so ago and got to see it sort of them run through the paces. It's fun for just a quick overview. It gives kind of the green, yellow, and red sort of stoplight versions, but for data geeks, you can dive into the numbers and see the trends over time and what's happening. So interesting sort of data on the historic closures of beaches.
The commissioner mentioned sewage treatment plants. James, what would cause the bacteria level in the water at a beach to rise to the level at which we might not want to go swimming?
Well, the answer to that is something called combined sewer overflows, or CSOs. And what happens is that the way our wastewater treatment infrastructure is set up, the storm drains that take rainwater from the streets and the sanitary sewers are combined before they enter the wastewater treatment plant, which in a sense is reasonable because the storm runoff is not clean water. But at any point, at the wastewater treatment plant, there are processes involved such as settling of stuff, which takes time. And if you have a heavy rainfall, there's often more water put into those plants than they can actually treat. So they basically have to let that water go. And so it goes out into the environment, you know, with sewage, et cetera. So in terms of, you know, where are better places to go swimming, first, you know, the farther you are from wastewater treatment plants or areas of high population concentration. Heading forward in time, one of the things that we are aware of is that rainfall events or total rainfall in Connecticut, if you just look at the records at stores or at the Connecticut agricultural station, has been increasing over time. And the prediction is that more of that rainfall is going to come as downpours. And so this problem may be getting worse over time rather than better.
So now you've talked about two things. And Jennifer, I'd like you to weigh in on this because this is all the effects of climate change, really. We're seeing more big storm events. And we've already talked about the fact that Connecticut's shoreline essentially is created by these very gentle waves that lap up from the Sound. But when you have big storm events, it erodes and it changes things. Now we're talking about heavy rain events, which overwhelm our wastewater treatment plants. Those are two things we can talk about. What else do you see as the problems of climate change and a changing environment on the beaches?
Well, the number one problem we're going to see is sea level rise. As the climate warms, the sea level is going to rise. And as Jim mentioned earlier, places that there used to be beaches are now wet sand all the time. And so what's going to happen as the sea level rises, the beaches are going to get narrower. And in areas where the beaches can't move landward, where there's infrastructure or development, then the beach is going to be kind of forced to become narrower and narrower. And the larger waves are going to come closer to the development, which is going to lead to more damage.
So what are we doing about that, Commissioner? I mean, how are we dealing with the effects of rising sea levels, the increase in the number of big storm events, the increase in the amount of rainfall? Obviously, it's something that you and your department is looking at all the time. This is something maybe 10 years ago we were looking at as a future problem, and now we're looking at it as a now problem and into the future as well.
It's a great question. And we are actually doing quite a bit, and I'll actually even go back to the challenge of sewage treatment plants. We've had over $1 billion investment in our Clean Water Fund to address these exact problems of sewage treatment plant and combined sewer overflows when the stormwater and the sewage water become too much and overwhelm a plant. We've been investing in both grants and low-interest loans to have those upgrades that really help the beach quality. It helps the water quality in Long Island Sound in general, which reduces the nutrient loading and the potential for dead zones, the anoxic sort of dead zones to happen in the Sound. The other thing that that did pass in this last legislative session were two new $20 million bond funds really focused on resiliency and adaptation and sort of the changes here along our coastline. So one is for low impact design and green infrastructure. And this is a $20 million bond fund that tries to slow the water that comes from these storm events and capture it and direct it in places that it's okay to be instead of places where you don't want it to be. That flush from the heavy rainstorm does carry bacteria and oils and things from our impervious surface. This bond fund is really directed at making the water percolate back into the ground in a safer and better manner. Another $20 million bond fund for resilient infrastructure actually focused on some of our low-lying sewage treatment plants and other critical infrastructure that, again, during large storm events, when those get knocked out or overwhelmed by water or flooded, that's an added problem that you're already having a problem of a big storm event to have your sewage treatment plant go down, as a few did in Irene and Sandy, sort of exacerbates that problem. So we're focusing our bond funds on these sorts of solutions. But again, we need the good work of you know the researchers who are here on the cutting edge, finding ways to make our communities more resilient through natural system engineering, through traditional engineering, sort of hardening and raising up structures. But then also the sort of social question. How do you get at these sort of these challenges that people love living down on the shoreline? They've been there for generations. They've had their families there, and this is their little piece of heaven. working that sort of the communications challenges, and then some of the economics and the insurance questions all sort of come into this mix. And you really need all those disciplines working together to come up with the solutions.
I know that the insurance folks have been looking at this for a lot longer than a lot of people because of their business. Patrick?
Yeah. Well, and I think the social question is a really, really interesting one, and particularly when we're talking about relatively small fixes like a beach nourishment program, kind of just like from my standpoint, I would even wonder, you know, if we're looking 50, 100 years out, is it wise that we're even undertaking projects like this when maybe we should just be saying, going into communities and saying, hey, you know what, you're going to have to build a little bit further back from the coast. Like that's the new reality if the sea level is rising. I don't know just what Jennifer, you would say to that or James.
Well, I don't think there's going to be a one fix. That's the main thing that we know about living in Connecticut along the shoreline, is that one solution is not going to work everywhere. As Jim said earlier, at some places we do need seawalls, and they will be effective. In other places, we may decide to move back. In other places, we're going to have to protect so we can maintain our position. And so everything is going to have to be done on a case-by-case basis and to determine what is cost-effective, what is going to be good for the society, what's going to be good for the environment.
Jim, do you have a thought on that? Because this whole idea of asking people to, if not move back from the shoreline, but at least engage in a conversation about what the shoreline should look like. This is a difficult one, a tricky one in a state like Connecticut.
It certainly is. You know, if I had a house on the beach, I'd be resistant to that conversation. but I don't. I have one that's close to it. I can see the beach, but I'm not of the beach. I think there's a couple of things to I agree completely with what Jennifer said. I think she is exactly spot on in terms of looking at multiple approaches. And I think, you know, part of that, again, I'm sort of a beach person. So part of that is I think we need to start thinking along the lines of sort of looking at climate impacts and resilience. Instead of reacting to emergencies, we need to be building resistance. And we need to be taking that same money that we would have spent on responding to a disaster and put it into building up resilience against future disasters. And that's a mindset that has to, I think, go from the community-based level all the way up to FEMA. Okay. In terms of looking forward in time, sea level rise, et cetera, and I think our resilience planning has to be sort of dynamic planning. So we can't just think, how high is sea level going to be in the year 2100 or 2050, which people do, because it's not going to stop rising at 2100. In fact, it's going to be rising probably faster than it is now. And so the question is, you know, looking forward to a series of changes, maybe changes that come faster and are more extreme, and how do you set up a plan that sort of is a, you know, has sort of rolling goals that are adapted over time. So you're thinking about the next step as you go forward. So, I mean, we could think about things from, you know, what can we do to build resilience for the next hurricane, all the way up to climate scientists talk about ice sheet failure. In other words, yeah. Greenland or West Antarctica ice sheet, maybe it's not just going to melt, maybe big chunks of ice are going to slide, break off, and slide into the ocean, and sea level is going to come up.
And this is the sort of cheery stuff that I knew we'd get to. We just have a moment before we have to go to our break, Commissioner. But look, researchers have to think about this stuff, and this is the sort of information, data, and forecasting that could and should help us plan at the governmental level. Government, as we all know, doesn't necessarily work like that. You tend to react more than you are proactive. So could you just talk about that in this context here a little bit?
Well, I think we actually have a good example of us trying to be proactive on two fronts. One, we've sort of newly formed a group called SAFER, which are state agencies fostering resiliency. And that group is really leading the charge for our application to HUD has a natural disaster resiliency competition with their last $1 billion of Sandy money that we're competing for as Connecticut, with this concept of really developing a statewide resiliency plan that builds upon our geologic assets. We happen to have high ridges that actually go all the way down to the coastline. And those can be corridors getting you in and out of the danger zone when you need it, feeding people back up to a resilient transit hub. So combining our goals of transit-oriented development, making those areas more resilient, places that people are living and working, and have those places be the core areas that we're working on resiliency and dealing with floodwaters, and then having those safe areas of egress and entry of either emergency personnel and whatnot to the lower-lying areas, and working there with things like living shorelines or berms to protect that infrastructure that has to be in those low-lying areas, but still find ways to get people in and out. It's a real innovative concept that we're doing in partnership with UConn and folks at Yale and our state agencies, which are really involved in these sort of fundamental questions on where we're putting people and how we're keeping them safe.
Yeah, and so unfortunately, there's a whole lot of people that move along train lines and I-95 that are built right along the shoreline that it's going to be really, really hard to move now or in 100 years. But we'll talk about some more of that. We've got a lot of calls that we want to get to at 860-275-7266 when we come back as we talk about Connecticut's beaches here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, last weekend we saw the 19th homicide in Hartford. It's the same number as all of 2014. We're going to talk to some community members and also with the chief of the Hartford Police Department about what this uptick in violence means to the capital city, whether more police on the streets might help. That's our conversation tomorrow. I hope you can join us. Today we're talking about Connecticut's beaches. We're taking your calls as well with Robert Klee, who's the commissioner of the DEEP, James Tate from Southern Connecticut State University, Jennifer O'Donnell from UConn, and Patrick Scahill, our own science reporter. Let's go to Jeff in East Haven first. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's up?
So yesterday I was with some friends, and we were walking along the beach in Brantford, and we just kind of plopped down and put some chairs down and went for a swim. And we were immediately told that it was a private beach club, that we weren't really supposed to be there, that it was a liability for them to have us there. And they pointed out all the amenities that we weren't allowed to use, which was understandable. The only thing is then they pointed to the water, and they showed us the area that was cordoned off that they had privatized for their club. And I was just wondering if there's any limitations on what can be considered private property and what's public access.
Thank you, Jeff, for raising that question. It's a very, very good story about something. So I don't know who wants to tackle this, but this whole question of private versus public beaches, we looked at some of the numbers. 23.5% of Connecticut's shoreline is publicly owned. That means a lot of it is privately owned. Most of it is privately owned. So to Jeff's question, Commissioner, I mean, what are we talking about here? Can he just plop down a beach in Brantford?
There are rules about the, and I believe it's on either the mean high water line or where. Oh, I'm getting a thumbs up from Jennifer over there that I'm actually correct on that. Below the mean high water line is sort of public property. That's, you know, the place that you can be and there cannot be restricted access. Challenges sometimes in some places getting to that location. Though we do have a whole plethora of public beaches and access points and boat launches. We've been working hard to really increase public access wherever we can and purchase open space and other parcels on the shoreline and turn them into parks wherever we can.
And I get that we're working hard on it, but am I right that about 23.5% of our shoreline is publicly owned?
It's either publicly owned or it's protected as open space. So about 20% or so you can actually go through and get your feet on the
side. I don't know. So, Jennifer, that means an awful lot of it is private. So you can walk along below the high water line, but above it, it's owned by somebody?
Yeah, private property owners own to mean high water. So for an average beach goer, if the sand is wet or has been wet, then that's in the public trust land. And
like
you
ever or just during that day?
I mean, well, you know, obviously it doesn't include storm surge. So that's just kind of the wet sand is public trust because that's between mean low water and mean high water.
Look, I get, and you come from California, Jim, that, you know, in California there's private land, there's public land. But in California, I'm used to beaches that are very, very long public spaces. I mean, do we have a problem really in Connecticut that we have so much of this wonderful beach land privately owned or very difficult to get to if you can get to it?
Absolutely. I think the advantage of having beaches more accessible to the public is that the public comes to care about their coastline, their nearshore waters, et cetera. And if they don't see it, if they can't get to it, then they don't care about it. And so I think it's in everybody's interest. I think I forget who had brought this up, but that in with Corps of Engineer projects, is they build out a beach. They're not going to build out a beach for private individuals. There's going to have to be public access to that beach. And I think that's a win-win situation. And I just think it goes against everybody's interest to have so much of the beach sort of privately held. People that put out little fences and signs, don't, you know, stand here, et cetera. I think they're going to find at some point in time that the property line is creeping towards their house. And at some point, they're going to go help. And it's just, you know, if the public feels that that's their beach that they're investing in, they're going to have one attitude. If it's like, you know, somebody's private beach, not so much.
I think that is a question that is very well answered by you just there, and I think that that's it. People are going to care a lot more if they can actually walk it themselves. I want to get to Nancy, who's in Westbrook, very, very quickly. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to make sure that you mentioned that for seniors in Connecticut, you can get something called a Charter Oak Pass that'll get you into the beaches for free. Some of your callers seem to be older people concerned with finances, and that's an option that's available to them.
Thank you very much. This is an interesting project.
No, yeah, the Charter Oak Pass is very popular, and it's sort of a lifetime sort of membership. I believe you're over 65 for a Charter Oak Pass. We also have state park passes for $67. You buy it once, you get in, you put a sticker on your windshield, you get in for free at all of the places where we charge for a parking fee. So those are good sort of options for folks like me, who actually go with my kids to quite a few state parks during the season.
One last call here from Jerry in Clinton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have an interesting question. I have a private beach in Clinton. It's right around the point from Kelsey Point. And this year, we have had more shells on our beach. And I don't mean just a few shells, tons of shells. We would try to get rid of them, and the next day they're back. I was just wondering if one of your panelists has an idea of what's causing this.
Jerry, thank you very much. It's a great question. Jennifer?
I'm not familiar with the beach, so I can't really say what's causing the influx of shells, but I don't know.
Would you have any thoughts, Jim?
I'm not a near shore ecologist, so this would be my guess, but I think that what's happened is there's been a change to the near shore ecosystem such that certain organisms, these things that produce slipper shells or jingle shells are sometimes called, they're very light, they're easily transported by low energy waves.
They slice your feet up if you walk on them.
Yes, they do.
I'll just say.
And they tend to collect against any kind of barrier to a longshore transport. And I've seen, you know, very large mounds of them. I think they may be associated with offshore rocky areas. And so I don't know what the ecosystem disturbance would be that would make, you know, it's very unusual for one kind of organism to become so dominant.
I'll just ask you, we just have a minute left, Commissioner, but is there any major change that your scientists have seen in nearshore ecology that may account for something like this, or just that people may be seeing on the beaches that they haven't seen before, jellyfish or anything else?
I can't speak to the slipper shells in particular, but our Long Island Sound is changing, and it is changing from things we've been talking about before, from changing water temperatures. That's a lot of what we do at the agency is actually collect that baseline data over 30 years of water quality, water temperature, and species. We do a trawl survey in the Sound, and we're noticing that we're losing our cold water species and gaining warmer water species. We're in this now very open question of whether we're a New England fishery or a mid-Atlantic fishery. So
I have a very important last question for you, and this is what keeps Patrick away from the beach. Are we going to see sharks, man-eating sharks in Connecticut anytime soon?
No, I actually asked my folks, there have not been a shark attack on one of our state beaches, and no Sharknado either, from the weather forecast.
No Sharknadoes in the forecast. Robert Clay, Commissioner of the DEP, thank you so much. Thanks also to Jim Tate, who's from Southern Connecticut State University, Jennifer O'Donnell from UConn and from Coastal Ocean Analytics, and our own Patrick Skay, who writes thebeaker.org. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thanks, Sean.
Our program today, produced by Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, Josh Nalea. Katie Filarski is the executive producer of our show. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.